position number 21580, Reel 2.
Eric Blanchard, Reel 2.
Yeah. Well, our dear Mon Mayma was ultimately did not complete the tour with the rest of us, and he went on to have with another crew and within a short space of time, he was missing, and unfortunately, as so many of them, no trace was found, and so he's commemorated we'll find that.
At Runnymede, you were thinking of.
Yeah, oh, he is. And so, unfortunately, was our midwife, our gunner, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. Well, anyway, so we crewed up, and we then had our first flight in the Lancaster bomber, and my pilot, Sergeant Stevens, of course, would have trained on Wellington bombers, ready, at the OTE, and now he's in the heavy conversion unit, and so we had to learn how to fly a Lancaster bomber, and in theory, I knew all about the Lancaster bomber, having done my flight engineer's course, it was quite exciting. And on my 21st birthday, my father sent me a £5 note. That's a piece of white paper, which is, that's a lot of money, you know. And my mother sent me some homemade sponge cake, and we sat underneath that Lancaster, and somebody produced a penknife, and we cut it up and all had a little piece of cake. And we went for a little flight, and then came back, went to a pub in the village nearby, out of beer, and the hatch came down. Back to the sergeant's mess, too late then, the hatch went down, so we didn't have a drink. And beer, of course, is quite short. It's 1942, yet it was getting short. So then we got posted to Scampton, which is quite a famous pre-war RAF station. What's it there? We are now posted to Scampton, and we then have to do one or two bullseye ops. That's training, normally try and sign somewhere in Wales, take a photograph of that, come back, see that the navigator found his way. In the meantime, this other strange squadron are flying around in Lancaster, and this was called 617 Squadron. They didn't seem to do any operations, they just seemed to be practicing, taking off and landing. There were no runways at the time, Scampton. There were, as the grass field, so bold people like that would take off two abreast, maybe three, going along that. But we hadn't yet done an operation, and we were about ready to do it. And one evening, I saw the 617 aircraft coming down to take off, and so happened they were taking off almost down in front of us, and they were strange. They changed their aircraft. They were in a great drum underneath, and they went off. We went off to our practice in Wales, came back and went to bed. Bed was very comfortable, really, for us. The old-fashioned married quarters, there's one crew per thing. So, you've got a kitchen and a We didn't use their kitchen, of course, but the next morning, a big low-loader lorry was outside collecting kit. That was always a bad sign, of course. We were no, we were a bit green because we hadn't yet done an op. But all of a sudden, all this kit was going into these. So that's the crews that hadn't come back. And then we were told we could go to the intelligence room and see something. And we went there, of course, and there we got the model of the dams that were used for the briefing and some early pictures of what the damage had been done. And you know, it was quite interesting. But we weren't to be there on the day when the king and queen came to hand out the medals, as we were only on leave. But it was now our turn to go on a real op. But of course, first of all, you have to do a second dickey. And ours was to be with the squadron leader Smith. And what's quite unusual was that his flight engineer must have been sick. So Sergeant Stevens, the pilot, and Eric Blanchard, the flight engineer, we had to go together. So I was the flight engineer, and Sergeant Stevens was the under instruction from Squadron Leader Smith, and we went tearing off somewhere to Duisburg, I think was right. And I remember navigators used to like to come out over the target and have a look and see what. And the navigator, I remember him now, is a Canadian warrant officer. And he came out and I was sort of pointing to things, and I stupid remember said, balloon barrage? No, I think that was flak. Of course, you think about 20,000 feet, there ain't going to be any balloons up there anyway. And then the other things, what are these showers going on? That's the incendiaries, the other, but your near neighbours dropping. They're going down and they come down on a shower. Oh my God, you know. Anyway, so we bombed the target and we're on Stooge and get away. And then there's a scream from the middle of a gunner. Oh, it's been, my lungs is collapsing. So the pilot's very good and he dives, pushes down and loses height very quickly. And thinking, well, I'm getting down to learn and see what happened. And I always remember that as that dive and went down there, you could see the moon on the Rhine. And I was never seen again like that. You know, it was reflection of, and the Rhine was lit up just a minute. And then the Timmeda Bagana said, oh, sorry, skipped. It was my life jacket, or Mae West as we used to call them. Mae West inflated accidentally. He deflated and he was all right. And that was what was crushing him in the turret. And so that was it. We got one up on the crew and we were... now, funny enough, I was then... and saw Men Only was quite a mild little book you could buy in those days. And I pasted on there and I put Dortmund... and I put the lot, actually, and wrote them under. So the next one will be Dortmund.
Can I have a look at what you've got in your hand, please?
Yes.
Is this something on which you recorded your operations?
Every day, every time.
It's a cartoon from...
Men Only.
Men Only.
Yeah.
That you've got framed, and it's entitled Blanchard's Folly.
Yeah. Yes, I did.
And on it, you've put the list of operations you did.
Yeah. And on the back, and really, I ran out of cardboard, so I used an old map, bit of RAF map. See?
Well, I can tell you what the order in which you did them, because I've got your logbook. But carry on with your memories, please.
Yes, all right. Well, Well,
That was your first operation on the 12th of May, 1943, by the way, to Duisburg, as you said.
That's right. Then our first one as a full crew, then, was Dornan, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. That's the 23rd of May.
Yeah. And I can't tell. Well, several times we were attacked by the enemy. I can't think whether it was that time or not. I think that we had very good confidence in the rear gunner and the mid upper gunner, and ultimately we had no confidence in the rear gunner. But I can tell you about that in a minute. But we were attacked, and I remember the time when we put the nose down, not just the Pommacon corkscrew, which was a very violent and evasive thing anyway, and so quickly, and built up such a terrific airspeed that everything went floating up the navigator's compass would have gone up the ceiling. Any Pternus flask would have been tied down. There were places to put all these things anyway. All your parachute loose. Everything's floated around. And I remember the pirate saying, could I give him a heave? And I was pulling away with him to try and pull up that aircraft out.
To pull up what?
Well, to pull out from the dive that we'd gone into. We're probably about 400 miles an hour, see? Other than just briefly saying that some of the other things did strike you was the terrific, the giant cones of searchlights, which luckily we never got picked up on them, but they were there with their big blue master beam. And you see an aircraft in there, it was grim. Watch out, probably getting shot down. And another thing was interesting. I never heard it happen before. After we left Scampton anyway, but we used to get somebody gave us the colours of the day to fire off as they for the Germans. How they got that, I don't know. But they used to do it. One of the other, and then another time.
What exactly do you mean?
Well, a very light pistol, and the colours they. I'll confirm it later, but I'm pretty certain that's what it was.
You mean you were told what the German colours of the day?
That's
were.
Right. Yes, that's right.
Were the colours of the day used?
Pardon?
Were these colours of the day used by you?
Yes, it were. As you said, if you thought you could get away then, fire it off. And the other thing we saw then, later on, was that we noticed in the target area, we thought the Germans were firing red very lights. And so we started firing then, and of course a lot of these things, it might be the crew thinking, you think that that's doing some good. Oh well, he's gonna. It's like people chucking down beer bottles out on the rear turret, with screaming noise. I don't suppose it mattered a tiny bit to any German down below. He wouldn't think it was going to be a bomb dropping, and anyway, he's nicely embedded in concrete in his flak emplacement. I sweat, but it's a favourite trick in rear gunners just to throw an empty beer holder out, thinking of the whiny nose. I'm not supposed to do any good at all. And that, I don't suppose the firing in the red, but what we thought was that they said, that will stop the flak. While I'm the fighter going in, because you At that stage, proceedings, the fighter was not being directed by the radar system and the worst of it. He's now on his own looking out for you as an opportune target, really. You're visual. In the actual target area, it's, so much is illuminated. And when you could see other aircraft and poor Brown below, you could see the poor old Stirlings and the Wellingtons. At that time, you see, they were still operation. They'd be down below, and you think, oh, God, poor devils. They aren't down there.
Coming back to the firing off of the colours of the day,
yeah.
Who in the crew would do that?
Yeah. The Wireless operator.
Why him?
Because I'll get the diagram or Les Lancas for a minute, and he could find the very pistol was there where he could try them off.
And from which aperture would he fire it?
Yes, sir. In a minute, I'll show you.
Just explain in words for the benefit of other people who will be listening to it.
Yes, well, there's an aperture that the gun would clip into. It's a fairly biggish barrel gun, very personal. And it would clip into there, in the ceiling, and
What else do you remember about these early operations?
Well, I remember the very vividly. Can remember the first night of window. You appreciate what window is, and that was the metal strips were, and that was to be on Hamburg. I think you might find. It might then, I said, the night. It was Hamburg. And they had equipped us with the boxes of foam. They'd given the flight engineers a tailor suit to wear, which is very uncomfortable for him because a tailor suit is, when wired up, it's a full rear gunner suit, really. And you didn't need that in the cockpit. The only time you would need that was then you got sent back to drop the window. The bomber aimer was giving a stopwatch. And his instructions, I've forgotten how many seconds, but he would tell, so window. Oh, it was everything changed very soon after that, and you would say window, and then you would pop then down the flare chute. In other words, you hadn't got a camera, the kites that had got window on board wouldn't have got a photographic camera or a flame, not a flame, but anyway, so. Sometime before the target, one was sent out down to the back, just below the rear gunner, and plugged into the oxygen, plugged into the intercom, and you approached the target. And this particular night, of course, was one of the nights when Hamburg was really aglow. It really. Even at that height, 19,000 feet. And when the bomb doors open, in the clear vision panel, you're looking out. You're then looking out at the cookie, that's the 4,000-pound bomb, and all the other things. And then you see the target down below, and you've got the bomb and the bomb doors around. And my God, you're praying for the bombs to go away and get rid of it. Here you are, you're seeing it live that night, and it was an awful experience. And I remember looking out another, even before the bomb was opened, looking out another window, and we'd heard about Daisy's Flat. I'd never seen Daisy Flat before until I got to Hamburg, and there was some peculiar type of flak when it's exploded in the air. Anyway, luckily...
What exactly does it look like?
Oh, I can't... Well, it was a lot... It was called Daisy because I presume it's... it was in a lot of explosion in a circle, I suppose. I don't know. But that, I do remember seeing it. Anyway,
now... Can you explain about this Daisy... this tailor suit?
Yes. Yes, tailor suit was a standard rear gunner suit, electrically heated suit. But I didn't want it... But that's what it issued us with. And... It was a ghastly experience because you were then in the cockpit normally doing your duties with the fighting, with the pilot there, flying there, doing what he wanted to do. and then you had to... Yeah. And you did... luckily, within... probably in the next stop or not after that, somebody thought, well, that's a bit stupid. And they cut a slit... And to put the window down, just about in the bomb stepping down, just about where you step down into the bomb airman's compartment. And the flight engineer or the bomb airman could check out the window then. And we didn't check it out quite the precision what the science buds had thought about, you know, this, because... that stopwatch business. Well, later on, when I went back to the second tour, I got a safe and all. I got a load of stopwatches in the safe. I was in charge of issuing out to flight engineers. I very much doubt when anybody bloody well used it. We stuffed up and stuff out the window, stuffed the window out.
So when you say tailor, is that like the job of the tailor or somebody's name?
No, the manufacturer of the suit was called Taylor, I think you'll find. T-A-Y-L-O-R, I think.
So when was the tailor suit used and when not? How was it decided?
Well, a bomber, the rear gunner, that's his standard this time, it's his standard gear. For flight engineers, from my memory, I don't know that I even got it in the log, but I would say probably by the very next trip, that was it. Somebody thought, this is silly. And it was stupid. I mean, it was... I would say that you'd have got people going LMF. You know what that means, of course. And the lack of moral fibre. That was to happen to our rear gunner eventually. And I remember we didn't get any response from him. And the skipper said, go back, find out what's happened. See if you can make contact. And so you clip a portable oxygen bottle on, which is meant to be about 15 minutes. And that would supposed to last you. But they weren't particularly accurate. And I think there was a little gauge on the top. But I went down there. I couldn't make anything. I clipped into the intercom. And no, he's still there. But he hadn't got blown away. So we came to the conclusion that when the target area arrived, he just pulled the plug on his intercom and he wouldn't reply to us. That's what it could have been. And then I remember go back to the cockpit, and I was pretty dodgy then, You must understand we're about 20,000 feet, you see. So you won't go long for that oxygen. And I thought I'd plugged into the main oxygen supply, and I don't think I could have. And I went unconscious for a little while, and by this time we descended a bit, and it came round, which is like, yeah. But so eventually our poor captain had to report this and say, well, we can't take him any longer. And so we took a succession of other people at times.
Did he unplug his intercom regularly?
Well, from then onwards, it must have been regularly. I'd have to ring up my friend and skip and say how many times was it, but it suddenly it had dawned as something was happening. We didn't get any reply. But the other man, the midair gunner, he was French by birth, and he's got this funny accent, and he was screened, but he was very active, and he was there all the time.
Were there any other symptoms of LMF with the rear gunner?
No, I don't know. He seemed quite okay back at base. Remember, we were at that time an all sergeant crew. Captain is going to be promoted to a pilot officer very soon, within probably a matter of a couple of weeks or so. But anyway, that was it. He went. Now, what other in the first tip?
Well, there's an operation on Essen here, in which this is the 25th of July 1943, in which you put Focke Wulf 190 shot down. Do you remember that?
Yes, we do. Yes. Well, I'll submit up a gunner. Yes. Yes. The other time I remember Focke Wulf 190 was in a another one of these raids where we are bombing through cloud all the time. All this is bumped, and there was a Focke Wulf 190 tearing towards, but luckily going the other way. And that's the first time I was able to identify anything like that. Normally, it's the rear gunner or the mid upper gunner would see the fighters, and unlike the Americans who were attacked by the front. That's another. Normally, the fighter would be on what in those days we the curve of pursuit, which is the normal traditional way. Until, of course, then you suddenly find that you're shot down from below with upward firing gun. But this time, of course, not so long after Hamburg raid, I suppose, the Germans had to get cracking with their radar, which they had done. And then, like with all our mosquitoes, they would be in the Junker 38 with a radar chap and upward firing guns at about 30 degrees, I think. And then you'd come back and say, there's flak at about 20,000 feet, and the powers would be, so unless I'm bloody not a conscience, what are you talking about? And that's what it was. I mean, it was up and firing guns. They'd stooge in underneath. They'd see the shadow of the Lancaster or Halifax right above them, bang. And not just a cannon. I think a one size up from a cannon, I think one of the guns was in. So it's pretty well set. And then, of course, when you see that happen, and you see the glow in the sky, and it gets bigger, and you know it's curtain.
You've also put here for a raid on Nuremberg, 10th of August 1943, you've put hit by flak, landed at Aldermaston.
Yes, we did. That's quite right. Yes. Yes, I think that's the very first time that we'd actually helped, heard and smelt flak. It was obviously predicted flak, and we were stooging along, probably long after the target, because you appreciate Newham was a long way from home. And I think we got a hole, and